Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the William Hill Sports Book Club, where we look at books that may be contenders for Sports Book of the Year. And this week it's a lost memoir of Britain's first black Olympic medalist, Harry Edwards.
Essentially, Harry had been airbrushed out of history and no one knew who he was. You guys didn't before you saw the book, and now everyone will.
Before his Olympic medals, Harry Edwards was a teenage prisoner of war in Germany.
There were a lot of grim things that happened in there. Death and disaster on almost a daily basis. But he doesn't feel sorry for himself. He doesn't feel sorry for himself at any point during this story, and he's got good reason to.
It's an incredible story. We're about to get stuck into it. It's the William Hill Sports Book Club. Hello there again. It's the William Hill Sports Book Club. I'm Adrian Durham. Neil Foggin, William Hill's media man, chief book reader, is here as always. All right, Foggy?
Hello, we all right this week?
Yeah, all good. Read any good books lately?
A few, and this one is up there.
Shall we get into those books a little bit later
on?
The title of this book is When I Passed the Statue of Liberty, I Became Black. It's the lost memoir of Britain's first black Olympic medal winner and the America he discovered. It's by Harry Edwards, edited by Neil Duncanson. And just briefly, Harry Edwards was born in Berlin, won two sprint medals for Britain at the 1920 Olympics, a three-time national champion, and Harold Abrahams, star of Chariots of Fire, 1924 Olympic 100-metre champion, described Harry Edwards as one of the greatest sprinters I ever saw. So the athletic story is fascinating. And then his life, as detailed in this book, is absolutely riveting. He was a prisoner of war in Germany during World War One. He met kings, he met presidents, he met world-famous writers, he met world-famous actors. He lived through the Depression in the USA, experienced racism and bigotry in the States. He worked across Europe in the aftermath of World War Two. He worked in the arts. He got a master's degree in international relations in his 70s. He went to Vietnam to help children with no chance in life. He returned to Harlem, where he lived, to help kids suffering from social inequality there. He had a heart attack and survived. His son had a car crash that left him quadriplegic just at the start of a promising military career. And I've barely scratched the surface with all of that. It's a life fully lived, mainly helping others, but also it's a story that needed telling because it's a full account of one man's life through various global struggles. And it's an important, authentic reference book in history. So basically, when you hear all that, this is someone you definitely want to read about. So let's bring in Neil Duncanson, who didn't just edit it, he discovered it as well. Neil, how are you doing? Good to have you with us.
I'm fine. Thanks very much indeed.
It's an extraordinary piece. And before we get into the book itself, a bit about yourself. You've got a history of sport, mainly in TV, also writing about sprinters as well. Give the listeners some Neil Duncanson context. How might they know you? What work of yours might they be familiar with?
Started in newspapers, went into TV in the late 80s with ITV, worked on the Olympics, got fascinated by the Olympics, started a TV business in 90. Probably the first big thing we did was the Italian football on Channel 4. We did the Graham Taylor, Do I Not Like That documentary for Channel 4. Mm-hmm. We produced Formula One, we produced the World Rally, the NBA. Then we went into factual programs as well. Most recently, probably the big Formula One series on Disney with Keanu Reeves, Braun, the impossible Formula One story. Always kept a keen interest in sport, even though we do an awful lot of factual and fact-ent now.
So you discovered the memoir and then edited it, and this is the resultant book. And the introduction written by you is fascinating. This memoir was found in New Orleans. How on earth did that happen?
I'd love to be able to tell you, Adrian, that it was a fantastic Indiana Jones story. with jungles and snakes and so on. But the truth is rather more prosaic. It was more a join-the-dots exercise. I was actually, during COVID, researching another edition of The Fastest Men on Earth, which is a book about the lives of the men's Olympic 100-metre champions. And we decided to add in the second and third place guys just to do sort of brief thumbnail sketches on those. And it struck me that I didn't know anything about Harry Edward other than his athletic record here in the UK. There was nothing before that, and there was nothing after that, which struck me as odd. So a little bit of digging, and actually, God, the internet's great. we managed to track down this rather little archive in Tulane University, just outside New Orleans. And when he died, Harry's widow had donated all his papers, his scrapbooks, photographs, correspondence, everything in 9 giant boxes to this archive, where it had sat pretty much untouched for 50 years. So they were great. The archive was super helpful. They sent me bits and pieces, which really did sort of whet my appetite. And I thought, in the end, I'm going to have to go. So I flew over there and sat there for 3 days going through 3 boxes and found in there various versions of this memoir, some handwritten. He'd started writing it in ink just before the war, Second World War, and he'd finished it in the late 60s, and there were various typewritten versions of it. One title was Dark Skin Columbus Discovers America. He settled on the one we have now, and I sat and read it, and it just was, frankly, jaw-dropping. A, as you know, you never find a lost memoir. That doesn't happen. And if you do, it's certainly not going to be a jaw-dropping affair like Harry's story. This wasn't just a sports story, although it's a great sports story. This was a man who lived his life on the coalface of 20th century social change. This was a man who really wanted to make a difference. Almost a Zelig-like character, who not just a passive observer of change, in particularly in America, but a lot in Europe and Asia as well, but a man who got stuck in and got involved and wanted to help make change. Along with everything else that were in those boxes, at his funeral there were loads of cards, and they were all in there as well. And there was one card, and all it said in it was, Harry Edward wanted to make the world a better place. And what better epitaph could you have?
Absolutely right. And Foggy, I don't know about you, but when I'm hearing Neil talk about finding a lost memoir, which you're right, that doesn't happen. I'm instantly thinking book, my eyes are widening, it's exciting. That is exactly what you need to make a really good book.
It is, and that's what excites me about this project. Sports Book of the Year is you get these sort of books come in where you don't know anything about it. I never heard of Harry Edward. And then you read it and you think, wow. And the fact that it's sat 50 years in a box, not touched. What I also like is the fact that he's got his rejection letters in this box as well, and you think, what was going on in that period of time? It's mental, but look, we've got it and we're here today to talk about it.
And Neil, on those rejection letters, there's one from a New York literary agent that said, it doesn't seem very lively. I mean, what are they reading? I suppose of its time, they might be thinking, well, this is what's going on right now. But when we look back on it, it does seem an extraordinary life that he had. Certainly very lively.
Well, I think the extra twist on this was the fact that it had so much relevance to today, so much prescience in terms of what's going on. I think if Harry were alive today, he would have hoped that things would have materially changed. And they materially haven't. There is still a need for Black Lives Matters. There's still things like George Floyd going on. I think he'd be very disappointed to see all of that. So I think there is some learning in there for us today, as well as a great story of a man's life.
Yeah, I mean, there's some blatant stories of racism in there. We'll get into a little bit later on, but there's, I mean, just an extraordinary book in itself. There's some amazing photos in there as well. And we were talking earlier, Foggy and I, about how we like the placement of the photos. It's not just a whole tranche of them in the middle of the book. They're placed as and when they're needed. And there's one of Harry Edwards in his running kit, smiling, shaking hands with King George V. Were all those photos in there, or did you have to come away and source them elsewhere?
Pretty much all the photos were in either envelopes in these boxes or in scrapbooks and photo albums that he'd kept and had never seen the light of day.
Wow.
And that was a beautiful thing about it. And I think also one of the things that Yale University Press, the publishers, absolutely loved about the project was that not only was it a great tale, but we had this wonderfully rich visual archive at the same time. So there's a wonderful picture, I don't know if you spotted that one, of him writing his complaint out after the 100. I'd never seen that. I hadn't seen most of those pictures that are in the book, and I managed to track down some brilliant guys from the athletics history world in this country who are fantastic. And they'd never seen these pictures either. And if they haven't, then no one has.
Just as context to that, there was a false start, wasn't there, in the race. And he's encouraged to make a complaint about it. Sits down, writes it out in the open. Just an extraordinary photo of its time. And then it's all kind of swept under the carpet. And I don't think that would happen in the modern world, to be honest with you.
No, it wouldn't. It was very British, you know. No, we don't go cap in hand to the French and the Belgians, old chap. No, it's never done. So they checked out whether they thought they would win, and when they realised there was no chance of it being reversed, they said, no, you can't make a complaint. The French athlete in the race did, and it was rejected.
Mm.
So they were probably right. But, yeah, he should have won that race, and had there been a proper start, he would have won that race. And he probably would have won the 200 as well, only because he was injured in the semi. He'd run the best times. He should have won two gold medals.
Yeah, I think when you read it, that becomes very clear. You're right. How much editing did you do on it? Because I'm intrigued by that question, and it's not any kind of criticism of the book at all. So don't misunderstand what I'm saying. But there's a beautiful bit of writing on page 132. It's the end of chapter 11. It says 1939. There's a piece which reads, quote, "Then suddenly the war clouds of World War II burst, drenching Europe in blood." I mean, that's powerful writing, beautifully painful writing as well. So did you edit that significantly, or is that Harry's writing?
That's Harry's writing. All we did was we took the various versions and we read them all. And because Harry, given the advice because he was getting knocked back all the time, particularly in New York, but also here from publishers and literary agents, and they kept giving him bits of advice like, it's too long, it's boring, no one's interested in that, no one's interested in the POW camp. So he just started subbing it all down. So the final version that he thought was the right version had missed so much good stuff. So we just ended up putting a lot of that back in. Some of it we've kind of edited just a little bit for context so you understand it. Sometimes he assumes a bit of knowledge that you wouldn't necessarily know. But we were very keen to keep Harry's language in there and Harry's writing, which is pretty good.
And it is, as it says on the cover, authentically written by Harry Edward. I found you mentioned the prisoner of war thing, I found that the most fascinating part of the book. I can't say I enjoyed it, but it was an education reading about it. It was frightening reading about it. So it was his account of how he became a prisoner of war in 1914. The detail's harrowing. And basically, just to sum it up, he was a British subject living in Germany, taken into custody by the German police before being sent to the prisoner of war camp. He was only 16 years old. 16 years old. And when he's in the police station, there's a police officer in there whistling the funeral march in front of him. He's 16 years old, being taken away from his family. Extraordinary story.
Yeah, he grew up pretty quickly in there. He spent the rest of his teenage years in Releben, which was a pretty grim place. Luckily, he spoke multiple languages already because he grew up in a house that was multilingual. So he managed to survive that pretty well. He ran in there. He took and passed exams in there. There were some positive things that came out of it, and I think it really did shape him as a human being. And that comes out loud and clear in the book. But I think also what it did was it pointed him at England, because he met a lot of people from the UK and several who were from the Polytechnic Harriers. So in his head, when he came over, that's where I'm going to go. And he'd already started to get a name for himself on the track in Germany. He would have run for Germany in the 1916 Olympics in Berlin had the war not happened. So instead, he ends up running for GB and breaking all the records at the 3A's. So it's a remarkable about turn, one of those remarkable life stories.
I'm always looking for football content, and there's actually a really significant gasp out loud football moment in the Prisoner of War camp, because Steve Bloomer is in that prisoner of war camp. I would imagine a lot of football fans listening to this know Steve Bloomer's name. If you don't, Derby County is probably greatest ever player. England international, scored over 400 goals for club and country. Taken prisoner because he was a British citizen coaching in Germany when World War One started. There's another footballer in there, Fred Pentland, and that story is ridiculous, because he's been invited over by the Germans to coach their Olympic football team So he's helping the Germans out, and they take him prisoner. It's outrageous. And I know it was retaliation to the British taking German citizens prisoners over here, and I get all of that. I understand what went on with World War One, but it just seems so outrageous. But there is some football content there. But also, very quickly, there's a I don't want to go into too much detail because reading it is the powerful bit. There's a moment in the prisoner of war camp where he discovers somebody who's tried to kill themselves, stab themselves to death. And again, we're talking about a teenager here, and you talk about growing up fast. That's a great example of it. It's a harrowing piece in the book.
Yeah, it is. It's not something you want to sugarcoat, so we left a lot of the hard facts in there. As I say, there were a lot of grim things that happened in there, death and disaster on almost a daily basis. But he's so dispassionate in the way that he writes about it. He doesn't feel sorry for himself. He doesn't feel sorry for himself at any point during this story, and he's got good reason to, particularly when he goes to America. But it's done in such a kind of straight and honest way that I think you end up, well, I certainly ended up having massive respect for the man.
Oh, totally. We've talked about his athletics career, and one thing that, like, stopped me in my tracks was how his athletics career ended, because he goes over to the States to run, and then it's like almost all of a sudden out of nowhere he stops running because he had a bad winter. Is it as simple as that?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, he suffered a lot of injuries. He was always pulling hamstrings. These were the days when clearly medical care wasn't what it is today. He was a big guy, very muscular, so he used to pull muscles a lot, and it happened in the Olympics in 20. It happened throughout his career. I mean, when I was chasing back through the actual records in the newspapers, I lost count of the amount of events he actually didn't take part in that he should have because of injury. So, yes, he was invited in 1923 to go and run at the Yankee Stadium. Of course, our esteemed Amateur Athletic Association said he couldn't go, that he had to run in some minor counties event here, and he said, oh, I'm going anyway. So they were going to ban him had he not emigrated anyway. So he went out, but I think he doesn't really talk about it much in the book, but I found out that he'd taken a different coach into that winter, and his coach had decided he just needed to do massages and not run and not do the stamina work, and it ruined him. So he placed nowhere in the three or four races that he had in the States, in New York and in Boston. He was hopeless. So he just thought, right, that's it. I'm done here. Move on.
Look, I'm going to deal with an elephant in the room here, okay? Because, Foggy, this is a contender for the lists for the books for William Hill Sports Book of the Year. And this is pretty much where the sport ends, when his track career ends. I will say there's a lot of relevance in terms of some of the racism here. There's a lot of relevance to what's going on in British football, which we'll get to a little bit later on. And he also, towards the end of the book, he reflects on the importance of sport and his athletics career. And I think that's quite an important bit as well. But I love reading books, any books on any subject, really. But I do love reading sports books. And this is about a very important sportsman in Olympic history and British sporting history as well. So I want to make that clear. Is there enough sport in the book? Foggy, first of all, what do you think?
It's going to be a subject we have to discuss. The rules state you just need to mention the word sport, or anything to do with sport, it can qualify. But it is a subject which we get when we get to September and we're discussing a long list and we're looking at what goes through and what doesn't. It will be asked, Is there enough sport in this book? And for me, yes, there is. There is enough. And it's more than a sports book. And you're looking for that perfect book which you could give anybody to list to read. And this one you could give anybody to read. There's enough sport, but it will be a debate. And it will be a debate between the three of us whether we feel whether this should make the long list, go to the judges, because I sat in many judges' chambers when they're discussing for the shortlist, and they go, they've discussed the shortlist and they're discussing what will win, and they go, is it a sports book? And we think, why have we got to this stage? That's what it's a thing. It's a debate, isn't it? It's subject. Mm. It's people's opinion all the time, and I think there is enough in this. And I think so far we've all read it. It will be in discussions later in the year. So let's see. I think there's enough in it.
Neil, did you write it as a sports book?
Not entirely, but I agree. I think there's more than enough sport in there to interest the sports fan. It wouldn't have been published had that connection not been made, because clearly the hook was, here's Britain's first black Olympic medalist, which gave us a purpose for it. And otherwise, I'm pretty sure I'd have struggled to find a publisher. But what also appealed to Yale, who have never in their lives published a sports book, was everything else that happened to Harry after his sporting career finished. So it's a bit of everything, in truth. There's the sport pre the First World War, which I think is fascinating about how he gets into sprinting as a kid. And of course, when he comes to the UK, the Olympic stories are great. Winning those three events on one day, not just one day, 1 hour, 100, 220, 440 in 1 hour. I mean, just crazy.
That is crazy.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Having read it, I thought about it, and I believe it is a sports book. I think that there is enough content there. And to bring it into modern times, if you compare it, say, to Sebco, Lorco, if there's an autobiography of his, it would have a lot of politics. He became an MP after his Olympic career, after his running career. So I would expect it to talk about his political career as well as his sporting career. One followed the other. It's the story of an important sportsman. And I think we're all fascinated what happens to sportsmen after their sporting career is over. Football book, it won't just be I did this and then my career ended, that's the end of the book. It's what goes on after that as well. So I know the question will be raised. It's why I've raised it on this show. But I definitely feel that there is enough there without for it to be considered an authentic sports book. He's an important figure, as I said at the start, in Olympic history and British sporting history as well. The racism elements in it, I think, are astonishing, Neil. It took my breath away, some of them. The first experience he had, if you look at the title of it, When I Passed the Statue of Liberty, I Became Black, this is a black guy in Europe who'd had no experience of racism wherever he'd been, and he travelled extensively across Europe. In Britain, he'd had no experience of racism. It didn't really affect him having a different colour skin. It wasn't mentioned to him. Goes to America, all of a sudden, it's a huge thing. Hence the title of his memoir. So there's an experience, I'll read it out, in the barber shop that he has in Paulsboro, South Jersey. He goes in, he says, "The first time I got my hair cut by the owner, who asked a number of questions about me and my work. On my second visit, I was asked to sit in the rear of the shop where I got my hair cut, but without much conversation. However, this time, the barber gave me a handful of Klan literature with its virulent outpourings against Catholics and the Pope and told me quite politely to seek another barber." Truly extraordinary. And that's his first experience of it. He must have wondered, hang on, I've just been in a prisoner of war camp. I've had to travel around. I've had to move. And this, I can't even have my hair cut here. An extraordinary story.
He was so excited about going to America because he'd followed Woodrow Wilson and what he was doing, and he thought, that's where I want to be, that's a place that's going somewhere after the horrors of a war in Europe. But he didn't even get off the boat before his life essentially was redirected. The form he has to fill in designates him as a Negro. That means he cannot get jobs that white guys have in the 20s. He ends up washing cars, he ends up doing menial jobs, dishwashing, all the usual stuff. But he fights back. He just carries on pushing and pushing and pushing and never stops. He's not angry about it. He's accepting of it, but he keeps pushing back. So when he's asked to fight school segregation in Philadelphia, he does and wins and loses his job over it. But he keeps pushing and keeps pushing. And that is also something I think, and this is quite important, I think, for Harry, is that that sporting background, that competitive nature, I think is what gave him the edge to do everything that he did in later life. I think it really coded him in terms of how he went about various tasks in various parts of the world. That level of fairness, honesty, integrity and sportsmanship basically coloured the rest of his life.
I think there's so many examples of it, and it would be wrong to go into them all here, because I think you need the shock of reading them. For example, why he needs a car to avoid racism. That one absolutely blew me away. The one about his mum, he brought his mum over when she was dying. That one, I refuse to say it here because you need to read it. It's an astonishing story. And there's another one that I will read, actually. So his first wife was white. Harry's first wife was white. And in conversation with the president of a college, Harry found out about the severity of racism in the southern states. Now, any language that we use on this show or is directly from the book, so nobody should be offended by it. It's directly from Harry's writing. It's from his book. It's of that time. Just wanted to make that clear. So I'm directly quoting from Harry Edwards' memoir here. He says, this president of the college pointed out that far too many white southern gentlemen would feel justifiably enraged at the sight of a white woman married to a Negro, enough to take the law into their own hands and murder one or the other or both of us. And that's, again, I think, Foggy, that this is, when we're reading these books, and we've read quite a number already, sometimes it's just down to the jaw-dropping moments that make you stop reading and just soak something in, take it in, because it's so hard to believe. And this book has that in abundance, those powerful moments.
Yeah, you take it in and then you emotionally start picturing it, don't you?
Yeah.
And it becomes, the words become, jump off the page, but it becomes alive to you and you think, how the hell, yes, we knew it was going on at that time, but how do we not know from this book? Why are we just suddenly finding out on these pages? And it's just, there's loads of bits within this book. Mm. You just think, what the heck was going on? And brings it to life. And yes, you know that the 1920s was depression. But when you're reading it firsthand, everything just comes to life. It's like, oh, I knew that. But you're seeing it from a different point of view. And it's the fact as well, when the titles we said, when I passed the Statue of Liberty, I became black. That has harrowed this guy, because when he comes back into America a few years later, he goes through the same again, and he's petrified of going through the same process. And then many years later, he flies into JFK, has come back from what he's been doing, and he's still petrified of being treated as this black person coming back into a country. And it's unbelievable to read that this happened, but it happened.
When you read the memoir, Neil, did it make you emotional? Did you shed a tear when reading it?
The instance you recall there about his mother and the funeral was just extraordinary. I mean, I thought that was appalling. And yet again, he writes it so dispassionately, as if it was just an everyday occurrence. But you know what? Perversely, he got it from both sides. So when he worked for the Federal Theatre Project in the 30s, the Lafayette Theatre in Harlem, and they were putting on all black plays and shows, and Orson Welles, then 20, with John Houseman, put on an all black version of Macbeth, and it stopped the traffic for 10 blocks in every direction. An incredible hit. And Harry was the general manager of the theatre, and they didn't want him there. The black cast didn't want him there because he wasn't black enough. So he wasn't black enough to be black or white enough to be white. So he was stuck right down the middle.
Wow. That's extraordinary. There's a piece on page 111, and it's, for me, it actually, this is why it's relevant today. A lot of this book is relevant today, because this is exactly how racism is now, how I see racism in this country. When I see racism, this is how it manifests itself. He writes, although the outward attitude of most whites may be friendly, it is too often a charitable stance dripping with consciousness of a gulf between And I think that, so basically he's saying white people are very nice to me, but what they're pretending is that we're on the same level. They always see themselves as above me. And it's like we talk about subconscious, or some people call it unconscious racism. That's exactly what he's talking about there in his memoir, written a long, long time ago. And here we are, 100 years on, still there.
Yeah, as I say, I think he'd be mortified that materially things have not changed in the way he had hoped they would. And he went through all of that thinking that at least things would change. They really haven't.
They haven't. And so that, were you surprised at how powerful that was and how relevant it is to today? Because without that, I mean, I don't know if you'd have been in two minds writing it, because it's such an important memoir and such an important figure in sporting history. But the fact that it's all still relevant today, was that persuasive to you?
Certainly was, and certainly was to the publishers, I think, as well. That its prescience, I think, has made everyone sit up. And I think it gives it an extra value on top of, it already has immense value in terms of a piece of history and a great story of a man's life. But I think it has extra power, extra resonance, because of not just what he fought through, but the hope that he had. And he's very hopeful at the end of the book that things will change. He's moving into the late 60s, into the 70s. He's hopeful that things will change. And I think anyone reading that now, it's quite an education that we haven't gone as far as we would hope, nowhere near.
His varied life took him back to Europe, Neil, to help the post-World War II relief effort. So they're trying to rebuild. There's a bit where he goes to northern Greece, and he's trying to rebuild northern Greece. And he's communicating back to the States for more supplies for the relief effort, for the rebuild. And a 5-ton truck goes missing. Okay. I mean, there's comedy in this book as well. 5-ton truck goes missing, believed to be stolen by the Greeks. And Harry spoke to an Australian colonel who told him this. This is the quote from the colonel. He says, "Don't be so harsh on my Greek friends. I taught them sabotage, how to steal, disassemble and hide automobiles and trucks when I was an intelligence officer flown into German-occupied Greece for work with the resistance. They learned their job well. I'm proud of the boys. They just can't stop." I think that's hilarious. How good is that? It's such a good piece. And authentically from its time as well. This is like, these are words from the time when they happened. And it's stuff we rarely get our hands on.
The place was in pieces after the war. And not just because of the Germans. There was internecine struggles from all over the place. And Harry was caught right in the middle of this. It was quite sort of a nascent United Nations then. But again, because of his experience, because of his languages and his intelligence, frankly, and diplomatic skills, he was chosen as the guy to go in and try and sort things out. And then he also moved on to Germany and to try and help with the refugee program there, which was colossal. But he still comes back to America, still full of hope, which is dashed pretty quickly as soon as he arrives. And there was a system in America, because he was qualified as a kind of an accountant and bookkeeper and so on. And given his qualifications, the way that the American Civil Service worked, by GS numbers, and he was qualified as a GS-13, and he could never get a job above GS-2. I wonder why.
Mm. Yeah, well, we know why. I think he knew why at the time. As well, there's so many little landmarks in there. He gives an account of personal insight into the creation of the Eastern Bloc under Stalin, and it comes out of nowhere, and I'm like, wow, okay. And it's so intelligently written as well. This was one incredibly clever guy. He goes to a crucial meeting in Strasbourg of Europe's post-war leaders, and he details some of the stuff that goes on in that meeting. And that's an important historical document, I think, that what he writes, I'm saying, is an or what you've edited here, is an important historical document, I believe.
Well, the remarkable thing about that is, of course, he did it as a hobby. He wasn't invited to this. He wasn't official at it. He just wanted to go and witness it, which you in those days you could do. But I think his take on it was probably smarter than the people who were in the damn meeting, and perhaps they should have listened to him.
And more authentic, I would say.
Certainly more authentic, and certainly more learned, given that he'd been on the coalface, both in Europe and before the First World War and during it, and then in America at the same time. So I think his international perspective on everything would have been worth listening to. But they didn't.
Of course they didn't. Let's go back to sport, because page 198, there's a bit on sport in there, and he talks about the Olympic Code provides a sound basis upon which equitable sports relationship with tolerance and good sportsmanship could be built. In sport, I reason, there is acceptance of basic rules by all participants, a recognition of the principle of equality and of Olympic ideals and traditions. Briefly, in sports, the world's youth speaks the same language, devoid of semantics. Furthermore, competitive sports provide a controlled outlet for combative tendencies, satisfying youth's sense of adventure by travel and public acclaim, while stimulating the imagination of thousands of non-participants. He's basically saying more sport should mean less war. And it's profound. It's deep. If you examine the words he's saying, it's deeply profound. And just as an aside, it adds more weight to the view that this is definitely a sports book as well.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I think it would have been wonderful, wouldn't it, had we managed in some way, either with the US or the UK, to involve Harry in the Olympic movement, which I think he could have helped advance perhaps quicker than it did, because he'd have been a marvellous advocate for the Olympic movement and to do things the right way. But he never got asked, so that's a shame. And certainly in America, because Avery Brundage was the boss of the American Olympic Committee, you wouldn't have got anywhere near it.
No, that's absolutely true. By the end of it, I'm thinking, you know, he goes to Vietnam, he's helping kids out there in Korea as well. He's trying to change people's lives on a global basis, then goes back to do it in Harlem as well. I mentioned before how important this is, an historical document, and we'll bear in mind it's also a sports book as well, Foggy, but I think it's one of the most important books I've read in recent times.
Couldn't agree more with you. I think I read a lot of sports books, and this one is just, as I said before, it's more than sport. It gives you history. You also see how this man was. There is no, like, there could be parts of this book which we've seen in other books which have been in over the years where a little bit feel sorry for me because this has happened in my life. There's none of that. He's very positive. He's very much doesn't look at the past. It's always looking forward, but using his experiences, it's fascinating. And yeah, I think it's very important. It's a book which we all sat there and said, this is a book which you said to someone, Adrian, there's a copy, you need to read this, yeah, or so-and-so, read this, because it's so important.
Yeah, have you had that kind of reaction from people who have read it?
The reaction's been really positive. I think what's really been wonderful for me, having sort of lived it for the last sort of 18 months, 2 years, is that essentially Harry had been airbrushed out of history and no one knew who he was. You guys didn't before you saw the book.
No.
And now everyone will. And Harry was so keen to have his story out in the world, and now it is. It's just a shame he can't see it, but now his story is out there. And I think it is an important piece of work. I think Harry wrote it incredibly well. I think he got some bad advice about subbing it here and there, but I think we've done a reasonably good job of getting the right bits back in the right
Very
order.
Good job, yeah.
And I am absolutely delighted that now people can read his story and take what they will from it. But I think there is a very powerful message in there about how you deal with life and life setbacks. And I don't think you'll ever find another person who dealt in the way Harry dealt with setbacks, and God knows he had a lot of them over the years, and just kept coming.
You've been in contact with his family in Europe, is that right?
So his sister stayed in Germany. Obviously, Harry's family are all dead. His second wife died and his son died a couple of years after him. As you said, he was quadriplegic, so he was struggling. He was quite young. But his sister Irene stayed in Germany during the war, which was lively. And her family, there's a few of them still left. And they sent me the very early pictures that are in the book.
Oh, they're lovely, yeah.
Of Carrie as a kid, and that wonderful picture of the whole kind of Prussian family,
yeah,
with these two black faces in it, which I think is profound.
Yeah, those are fantastic pictures. I love the picture of him where it looks like he's wearing a dress.
Yeah.
And he's a toddler. It's a wonderful picture of its time. The last photo in the book on page 263 is of Harry standing, hands on hips, running kit on, out on the sports field. He looks very contented. It's early in the season that culminated with the Olympic Games. I think the caption I think you must have put on, "The world at his feet." And I think it's a lovely way to round off the story. It's a wonderful picture. Again, brings us back to the sporting element, which is the crux of it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, at his peak, that picture, I think between 1920, 1922, he was, I think, pretty much unbeatable as a sprinter over 100 or 200. It's a shame he didn't do better in the Olympics. It was kind of out of his control in a way. But he was remarkable. And as I think you mentioned earlier, Harold Abrahams was a huge fan. And it did strike me, actually, that had Harry got his just rewards in 1920, would there have been such a hue and cry about Abrahams and Little in 24? Would they have made a movie about Harry before Chariots of Fire? I don't know. We are now trying to make a drama series based on the book, and we've already cast Harry's character, who is an ex-athlete. So I'm hopeful that the story will grow, and I'm also very pleased that Harry's story is going to be out there for everyone, and I think Harry would be too, smiling somewhere, I hope.
I am so excited about that. And I was going to ask you whether it's going to be made into a film or whatever, and then I thought, hang on a minute, as you were explaining that, he's got a history in TV. Of course it's going to be a film. That should be exceptional. We're all up for cameo roles as extras, aren't we? I think, if invited.
Excellent.
What impact would you say this book has had on your life?
A very positive impact. I thoroughly enjoyed doing it. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. As I said at the start, you don't find lost memoirs at all, let alone memoirs that are such an extraordinary ride. And I doubt I'll ever be able to do anything like this again. So I'm just going to enjoy the ride.
We enjoyed the read, never mind the ride. So it was fantastic. Neil Duncanson, really appreciate you coming in. Thank you very much. And congratulations again on such a wonderful book. When I Passed the Statue of Liberty, I Became Black, the lost memoir of Britain's first black Olympic medal winner and the America he discovered. It's by Harry Edward. Neil Duncanson edited it. It is brilliant. And there is one question, Foggy, I want to ask you. When you get these books submitted, how often do you get books written by somebody who's no longer with us?
I think in my experience, which has been for the last, this is my fifth year of doing it, we've never had one. Now someone's going to say, yes, we did, it was 2 years ago. But to my knowledge, we haven't had one. And that was the question we got asked, was could it be entered because the author was dead? And I didn't really think about anything. I just said, yeah, of course it can, because there's no rule about it. And then when you find out that this guy's been dead for 50 years and this manuscript sat in a box, it's bonkers, absolutely bonkers. And you sit there a little bit annoyed with yourself that we haven't heard the story or knowing nothing about it. It was brilliant.
When you get books coming in, what's the process? How do you decide what's making the list or not? What actually happens physically?
So as we go along the year, the beginning of the year is quite slow, and we are encouraging publishers, authors, agents, etc., get your book in early, because that's when we've got time. And it's easier to consider a book when you've got time. When we get to the later stages of the competition, so we'll be announcing the long list at the end of September, at the beginning of September, we can have 40 to 60 books to read in 2 to 3 weeks, which is absolutely mental, and we do it. But if you get your book in early, You have, in my opinion, you've got a great chance, because we've got more time to give that book. Yes, I know that there's books which come out in July and August. You can't always get it in. And those books will be given consideration. But if you're entering your book in September and it's been out for 11 months, 10 months, I'm sorry, but you're not giving yourself any favours here. Get it in as early as possible.
That's the message. I don't know about you, right? I'd love to know your speed of reading, because I like to read. I like to make notes on a book when I'm reading as well. At my peak of voracious reading, it was 25 books a year. And I think that could happen quite often. The day job gets in the way a lot, but you need to read quicker than that, don't you?
So I do around 100 to 150 books a year. And that's cover to cover. And I try to, like you just said, the 25 books, I try to do at least 24 of those books, which have nothing to do with sport.
Right, really?
Because when we finish in September reading, if you don't carry on reading, when you get to January and we're starting again, it's a little bit slow and it's a little bit hard. You lose that skill, you lose that speed. So I try to keep reading, and that's when I try and I don't read any sport. I go to music books, whatever, non-fiction. I'm not a massive fiction person, and I try and read other things just to keep going. And even if we have a drop a part of the year, which happens sometimes, again, pick up a book just to keep it going. But people say to me, so you do 150 books in a year, that's 3 a week. And I go, well, it's not, because if you think for Sports Book of the Year, we're reading 150 books, that's done between January and September. So 9 months. Sometimes you only got one a week. Sometimes you've got one a day you're reading, or two a day. Luckily, I don't have anything outside of work, so I don't have a life. So this fills a massive part of it. But it's great. I love Sundays. I love the fact on a Sunday I can wake up with a pile of books and just try and get one, two, maybe three of those read very quickly and enjoy them. Some books are easier than others, but as we go through the year, the three of us, me, Nancy and Matt, will sit down every 4 or 6 weeks, and we have our version of book club, which is we go through those entries and go, right, what do we think is a maybe? And then so we can start whittling the 150 down to roughly when we get to September, we have a meeting where for 3 hours we sit down and we'll create the long list. But you're creating it from maybe 50 books, which you've got the 150 down to 50, and then you get that down to 15 to 18 books.
Wow, that's some process. Fair play to you for that. We've got books coming in all the time. You've got books coming in all the time.
Yes.
I'll run through a list. You pick up on what you want to talk about. Si Senor, which is Roberto Firmino's book about his time at Liverpool. We Were Really There, from David Bernstein, who used to be at Man City. Massive, The Miracle of Prague, Pete May, about the West Ham winning the Europa Conference League. And I'm intrigued. I haven't read that. I'm intrigued by the word massive on that. So
we'll wait and see.
Yeah,
we'll
absolutely.
Wait and see.
Enigma on the Track, David Sharp. Great Rides, Grant Thomas. Arthur Push and Run Row is a book I'm really interested in. I recently read Answer Prayers, Duncan Hamilton's book on the 66 World Cup, and he educated me on Arthur Rowe. Really important figure in Tottenham Hotspur's history and football's history, because you could trace back what Arthur Rowe was doing, what's gone on with Johan Cruyff, Guardiola, and to modern tiki-taka.
And I think that's the beauty of, and why I really like being part of this competition. It's, I'm a sports fan. I'm not a massive football fan. I'm not a massive boxing, etc. I'm a sports fan. And I love the fact that someone can give me a book, and the Arthur Rowe one, I don't know anything about this guy, but I will sit there and read it, and then probably come to you in a few weeks' time and say, I didn't know he did this, I didn't know that. And you'd be a bit embarrassed that you know what's happened, but you didn't know it was all to do with that person. Mm. And that's the beauty of a book, isn't it? That you learn something. And that's the beauty of this prize. And that's what I really enjoy doing. And that's, you're looking for those books which you can give to somebody. You could give to your mum and say, Mum, I know you can't stand sport, but read that because I think it will change your opinion, or you'll get some connection from it.
If you're a writer and you've written a book, a publisher who's got books out, get those books in early if you want to win the William Hill Sports Book of the Year.
Yeah, it's going to help you. And then we've got books which we can be discussing here.
And which we will do next time as well. It's been fantastic speaking to Neil Duncanson. Foggy, thank you very much for coming in again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Till next time, this has been the William Hill Sports Book Podcast.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.